Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we cut through the noise, examine the most complex financial and geopolitical material, and extract the high-value insights you need to be well-informed. I'm Chris Vanderbilt, and I'm ready to guide us through an incredibly dense stack of sources today.
And I'm Alex Astor. We're here to connect the dots, especially when the dots span from boardroom maneuvers in Silicon Valley to the technical architecture underpinning global finance. Our goal, as always, is to synthesize this information into coherent, actionable knowledge for you.
Our mission today is a deep dive into the latest intelligence from the financial world. We are focusing exclusively on the latest issue, Barron's Magazine, for the week of October 27th, 2025.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a massive amount of material here, everything from a seismic shift in how the U.S. government interacts with corporate America to the anxiety fueling Wall Street's push for 24-hour trading, and even why the Federal Reserve might be pausing its most critical monetary policy tool. Oh, and whether you should take the stairs.
Yeah, it's quite a range. What stands out immediately, I think, is how this material really confirms a fundamental truth about the modern market. Policy and technology have become the primary drivers of market activity.
Right.
Purely economic factors are, you know, often secondary now to government industrial policy, geopolitical imperatives, and these technical shifts in market structure.
Mm-hmm.
We have to analyze the source material through that holistic lens.
Okay, let's unpack this then and maybe start with what might be the most significant structural change covered this week. The cover story. It's titled, How Trump Sparked a New Era of State Capitalism. This isn't just theory. It sounds like it's happening right now. The U.S. government is actively becoming America's most powerful strategic investor.
It is a profound, I'd say, structural shift in the relationship between D.C. and American industry.
Yeah.
We are seeing the federal government pushing the boundaries of its traditional legal authority,
mm-hmm.
Taking equity stakes in strategic companies, moving beyond just grants or loans. Mm. This unfolding system of American state capitalism, as Barron's calls it, involves investing billions in exchange for direct ownership. It's quite something.
What exactly is the government trying to achieve with this unprecedented level of direct corporate influence? What's the stated goal?
Well, there are three publicly stated goals, and they're pretty effective, politically and economically speaking. First, bolster domestic supply chains,
yeah.
Make us less reliant on rivals, particularly China.
Okay, makes sense.
Second, genuinely make money for the taxpayers. The administration is really marketing this as the public finally getting a return on its investment in innovation.
You know? Right, the taxpayer gets a piece of the upside.
Exactly. And the third goal, which really underpins the first two, is the geopolitical imperative,
mm.
Using financial muscle to win the global technology and manufacturing race, especially against, well, non-market economies.
And the sources provide some pretty compelling examples of how this is being executed. Let's start with maybe the most high-profile deal mentioned, the Intel stake. Can you walk us through the specific financial engineering used there?
Certainly. So the U.S. government agreed back in August to buy a 9.9% stake in Intel. Now, crucially, they bought this stake at $20.47 per share.
Which was a discount.
A significant discount to the market price at the time, yes. The stock recently traded closer to $38, meaning the taxpayers already, you know, enjoying a robust paper return. But the key context here is that this wasn't exactly fresh cash.
Oh.
The Trump White House argued it was essentially rectifying a prior administration's deal. They converted grants and loans, originally intended for semiconductor projects, into equity instead.
Hmm. So it sounds like a highly effective use of leverage. They got a discount, they secured a large stake, and as part of the deal, they actually removed certain project milestones Intel previously had to meet.
That's right.
It's capital, regulatory relief, and ownership all sort of wrapped into one package.
Precisely. And now look at the critical mineral sector. Here, the government is sometimes becoming the largest shareholder. Take MP Materials, for example. They operate the Mountain Pass rare earth mine out in California. The Defense Department invested $400 million. Now, that money was structured to give the government preferred stock and a warrant that converts to a 15% equity stake.
A 15% stake. That makes the U.S. government the single largest shareholder. But the analysis needs to go beyond just the share count, right? What's the real significance of how that deal was structured?
The significance lies in the commitment. The Defense Department didn't just hand over money. They guaranteed a minimum price for some rare earth products. And even more importantly, they guaranteed to find customers for 100% of the magnets produced at a new facility for an entire decade.
Wow, 10 years.
That level of long-term commitment completely de-risks the project for other private investors. It's the regulatory muscle combined with the capital that's so potent.
And we saw this pattern repeated, didn't we, with Lithium Americas and Trilogy Metals?
Yes, 5% and 10% stakes respectively. Plus, you saw the immediate reversal of a previous decision, fast-tracking that crucial 211-mile road for an Alaskan mining project. The government steps in, things happen.
This really highlights the influence factor, doesn't it? When the U.S. government has skin in the game, it provides this implicit political and financial backing that, well, private investors simply can't ignore.
Absolutely. The CEO of TechMet even noted that the U.S. involvement was the major selling point that allowed them to subsequently raise $180 million from the Qatar Investment Authority. The government's stake was the seal of approval.
And that influence isn't always tied directly to equity, is it? The sources point out the government is exercising control through other means, too.
Correct. For instance, the ongoing discussions with NVIDIA and Advanced Micro Devices, AMD, they're being asked to give the U.S. government 15% of the revenue they earn from AI chip sales in China in exchange for export licenses.
So profit sharing in exchange for market access, that's quite direct.
Yeah.
Then we have the golden share veto power, which the president used regarding the U.S. steel sale to Nippon Steel.
The golden share is perhaps the ultimate expression of this new toolkit. When the sale was approved, the U.S. retained the right to veto certain operational changes deemed against the national interest.
And they used it.
They did. Last month, President Trump exercised that veto power, blocking U.S. Steel from halting raw steel processing at an Illinois plant. Even though the company argued it was a sensible business decision, the government asserted its national security and employment interests. So you have equity, profit sharing, veto power. It demonstrates the permanence and seriousness of this industrial policy pivot.
Now, this is where the dialogue needs to get a bit nuanced. How can an approach like this be praised by both the administration's Treasury Secretary and someone like Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent? Are they fundamentally arguing the same thing, or are they just, you know, praising different aspects?
That's a great point. They are praising entirely different aspects, which is precisely why the policy is so politically effective, frankly.
Uh-huh.
Sanders and other progressives focus on the taxpayer return. They argue quite reasonably that if the government de-risks a technology or an industry, the public deserves a financial upside. It prevents companies from privatizing profits after socializing the risk.
Okay, that makes sense from their perspective.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, however, focuses on the strategic national interest and geopolitical competition. He's signaling that the U.S. is just getting started. He mentioned 7 critical industries already identified for potential future intervention. 2 very different motivations finding common ground in the policy.
But the criticism from traditional free market advocates is pretty scathing, isn't it? Jeffrey Sonnenfeld of Yale called these equity demands nothing more than extortion schemes. And he mentioned acute anxiety among top CEOs.
He did. And the Cato Institute's position is even more dire. Norbert Michel warns that this kind of heavy-handedness fundamentally undermines the U.S. economic system. He suggests, quote, "You don't have to go too far to get to a completely different economic system, even invoking the specter of socialism or fascism."
Wow.
The concern there isn't just about a single deal, but the precedent it sets. If a government starts deciding who gets funding based on strategic goals, how does that corrupt the capital allocation process over time? What message does it send to other investors, both domestic and international?
But for now.
For the moment, however, the financial success is hard to argue with. TechMet noted the U.S. government has apparently seen something like a 30% annual return on its investment so far. That kind of return just fuels the appetite for more.
That is a staggering analysis of a structural shift. It really feels like it could define market dynamics for decades.
Okay, so we've discussed the government taking unprecedented control over corporate strategy. Now let's pivot and look at the anxiety building within the market's own mechanisms. There seems to be a palpable fear on Wall Street because 24-hour stock trading is coming, and the sources say it's pretty much inevitable.
Yeah, the inevitability seems clear. It's being driven largely by global retail demand, particularly from Asia. You have investors there who want to trade U.S. mega caps without waiting for New York market hours.
Right.
And it's following the lead of crypto and commodities, which already trade around the clock. Key providers like the DTCC, the clearing and settlement backbone, are actively preparing for continuous trading by, they say, the second quarter of 2026. The major exchanges, NYSE, NASDAQ, LSE, they're all developing plans. But institutional Wall Street is described as tepid. which, you know, in Wall Street terms, often means they're terrified. What are the core risks highlighted in the sources? Why the anxiety?
The risks seem to fall into three main buckets: operational stress, liquidity danger, and the big one, systemic contagion.
Okay, let's start with operational stress. The idea of equity traders needing to be staffed at midnight sounds, well, completely incompatible with the current financial system structure.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
John Shemis was quoted saying this will create a new level of stress and anxiety for traders. They currently use those hours between 4 p.m. and 9:30 a.m. Eastern to handle compliance, risk assessment, clean up their books, and crucially, sleep.
That breathing room.
Yeah, breathing room is essential for systemic health, frankly. Asset managers are asking really existential questions. Do we need three shifts? How does that impact compensation, stress levels, error rates? It's a fundamental change to how things operate.
And the liquidity danger seems substantial, especially given the current after-hours volume. Right now, trading volume between 8 p.m. and 4 a.m. is tiny, only 0.2% of the total daily volume.
Precisely. And low liquidity is the enemy of fair pricing. Think of the market like an auction. When fewer people are bidding, the gap between the highest bid and the lowest asking price, the bid-ask spread, it widens dramatically.
So retail investors could get burned.
That's the fear. Retail investors who place orders at night, maybe reacting to some global headline, are likely to receive significantly worse execution prices than they would during the main trading session. Benjamin Schifrin of Better Markets warned that without deep liquidity, these investors are likely to do far worse in terms of price.
And the greatest fear, the one that probably makes regulators sweat the most, is systemic contagion. The idea of a major financial crisis unfolding at, say, 1 a.m. on a Tuesday.
That's the really terrifying risk. When a banking executive asks, what happens if a bank collapses at 1 a.m., they are pointing directly to the loss of reaction time.
Right, like during the Bear Stearns crisis.
Exactly. Regulators and executives had nights and a weekend to sort of scramble and organize a response. In a continuous 24/7 market, that breathing room completely vanishes. A major negative event could instantly cascade across the globe, triggering automatic selling, flash crashes, potentially preventing any organized regulatory response until the damage is already done.
So who actually benefits from this seemingly inevitable shift? If institutions are nervous and retail might get worse prices.
The sources are pretty clear on this. This change favors the sophisticated high-speed players. It privileges proprietary traders, hedge funds, and machine learning operations that can consume news and act on market anomalies instantly, anytime, anywhere. Victor Hagani's assessment was quite pointed. He said 24-hour trading will likely facilitate a greater redistribution of wealth from retail speculators to proprietary traders. It's basically an acceleration of complexity that fundamentally advantages those with the best tech and the deepest pockets.
That's a sobering thought regarding the health of the financial mechanism itself. Okay, let's switch gears from market structure to a specific stock pick within the financial sector. Barron's highlighted, Progressive stock got hit after earnings, but the article frames this as a significant buying opportunity for what it calls a great financial company.
Yeah, Progressive is definitely a dominant force in auto and property insurance. Some analysts even describe it as more of a technology company that just happens to sell insurance, given their data prowess.
Right.
The stock is on sale, as the article puts it, down about 20% from its April peak.
Right.
The immediate triggers were pretty short term, a mild earnings disappointment, some concerns about rising repair costs, and policy growth slowing down, though slowing from 20% earlier this year to a still pretty robust 15% pace. Investors just saw slowing momentum and hit the sell button.
But the long-term history here is phenomenal, isn't it? This company has dramatically outperformed its peers and the broader market for decades.
That's absolutely the key context. Since its 1971 IPO, Progressive is up over 2,500-fold. It's consistently beaten the S&P 500 and its main rival, GEICO. The core differentiator really seems to be its early and aggressive adoption of telematics and data analytics. Adam Cecil noted they effectively use technology to price risk far, far better than competitors.
While GEICO struggled.
While GEICO, owned by Berkshire Hathaway, kind of struggled technologically, Progressive used data to gain 75% more auto policies since 2019. They grew to 26.2 million policies, while GEICO actually shrunk its book. They possess this deep competitive moat built on superior information.
And the valuation right now looks appealing compared to its historical average.
Exactly. It's trading at only 12 times projected 2025 earnings. That's significantly below its 10-year average PE of around 16. Furthermore, you have to consider its innovative capital return program.
The special dividends.
Right. Progressive maintains a small regular dividend, but returns massive amounts of excess capital via special dividends, much like Costco does. They declared a huge $4.50 special dividend in 2024, and analysts fully expect a similar declaration this year. That really sweetens the deal for patient investors looking at total return.
But we can't ignore the headwinds, can we? Both political and technical.
No, definitely not. Politically, the high cost of auto insurance is a real lightning rod issue. Progressive recently had to rebate $950 million to Florida policyholders because of outsized profits there. That demonstrates the regulatory risk clearly.
And technically.
Technically, Doug Bush noted the stock is showing a bear flag pattern on the daily chart. That often indicates that downside momentum is accelerating, unfortunately. So while the fundamental story looks strong long-term, technical investors might want to wait for a positive inflection point, especially since a move below the $217 support level could signal a further drop, maybe towards $200.
Okay. Let's discuss another major financial player, one that's entangled in both the AI spending boom we've touched on and the whole private credit controversy, Blue Owl Capital. Their stock is down more than peers, which seems to reflect broader sector anxiety.
Yeah, Blue Owl has become a real powerhouse in the direct lending space. They grew incredibly rapidly to manage $284 billion in assets, largely specializing in private credit through these things called business development companies, or BDCs.
Right.
However, their stock is down 26% year to date, which is worse than competitors. It seems to be due to this generalized market wariness that rising interest rates might eventually lead to a spike in defaults across the private credit world. The market's concerned that once rates maybe start to fall, some borrowers might struggle to refinance, causing problems for lenders like Blue Owl.
And they were rather famously at the center of the cockroach debate, weren't they?
Ah, yes, the cockroach debate. It started when J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon warned about risks, the cockroaches lurking in the private credit market. Mark Lipschultz, Blue Owl's co-CEO, responded rather pointedly at a conference by suggesting, well, that there might be a lot more cockroaches at J.P. Morgan.
Ouch.
Yeah. While the firms have tried to sort of downplay the friction since then, Lipschultz's underlying argument is that private credit firms like Blue Owl actually have better underwriting standards and more control over their debt than, say, the broadly syndicated loan market that banks like J.P. Morgan dominate.
The article mentioned Blue Owl adopted a classic growth-focused model, scale first, monetize later, allegedly underpricing services to gain deal flow. Now that they have this scale, is the market scrutinizing the sustainability of that strategy, especially with credit quality concerns rising?
That seems to be exactly what's happening. The strategy worked to build massive scale, but now, just as credit quality concerns are mounting, the market is questioning if they can maintain margins and profitability. Despite this wariness, though, some analysts, like those at Goldman Sachs, are calling Blue Owl undervalued.
Why?
They note that the stock trades at about 21.7 times fee-related earnings, which is apparently 5% below its two-year low. The bull case rests on the stability and predictability of their recurring fee income stream, which they believe warrants a higher valuation than the market is currently giving it credit for.
Okay, now let's talk about a major piece of corporate financial engineering that actually involves Blue Owl and a tech giant we've been discussing, Meta Platforms. Mark Zuckerberg is aggressively spending something like $70 billion on AI data centers. And to manage the resulting balance sheet stress, he got incredibly creative involving Blue Owl.
Yes, this is a perfect example of a company prioritizing strategic growth, winning the AI race, while using some really clever financing to manage investor expectations about cash flow. Meta's massive capital expenditures, driven by the need to build the infrastructure for their AI models and services, were starting to severely depress their free cash flow numbers, which was worrying analysts.
So what did they do?
To fund their massive Hyperion data center project down in Louisiana, they created a joint venture with Blue Owl Capital.
And the key structural detail here is that Meta will only own 20% of the joint venture. Why is that 20% ownership threshold so vital to their accounting?
Okay, this is critical for listeners who want to understand corporate financing tricks, maybe. When a company owns less than 20% of a venture, GAAP accounting rules generally allow them to avoid consolidating the massive debt and capital expenditures of that venture onto their main balance sheet.
Ah, it stays off their books.
Essentially, yes. It's known as the equity method of accounting. If Meta owned, say, more than 50%, they'd have to consolidate the entire CapEx, making their free cash flow look much worse. By holding 20% or less, they effectively get the strategic benefit of the data center while avoiding the immediate negative impact on their consolidated cash flow statement. This keeps analyst valuations healthier.
So Meta contributes land and assets valued up to $3.3 billion, gets a $3 billion payout from the JV. Blue Owl provides $7 billion, financed partly by selling bonds. It seems like a really elegant solution to fund a massive strategic shift, winning the AI race without crashing the traditional financial metrics that Wall Street obsesses over.
It really speaks volumes about Zuckerberg's commitment, doesn't it? And he's also been disruptive internally, launching the TBD lab and Meta Superintelligence Labs while simultaneously laying off 600 workers across other AI units. It was a swift reorganization, demonstrating a pretty brutal focus. If you're not core to the new AI mission, you might be out. His single goal seems to be ensuring Meta is not disrupted by the shift to AI, even if it requires aggressive, non-traditional financial maneuvers like this, JV.
Okay, let's zoom out now from specific companies to the broader mood in the market. The Barron's Big Money poll reveals a pretty stunning shift in sentiment. The bulls are charging back, apparently.
Yeah, the change in market psychology is almost whiplash-inducing. Professional investors calling themselves bullish have surged to 47%. That's up from a 30-year low of just 28% back in the spring.
Wow, quite a jump.
A rapid turnaround, fueled by three main factors, it seems.
Yeah.
The S&P 500 significant rally, it's up 40% from its April lows. The euphoria surrounding all things AI, and the widely expected beginning of the Fed's rate cutting cycle.
And what are the forecasts looking like?
The median forecast suggests the major indices will gain somewhere between 9% and 10.5% through the end of 2026. And a massive 38% of managers expect S&P 500 earnings per share growth of 6% to 10%. But here's the major cognitive dissonance, the real tension.
They're bullish, yet they fear the bubble.
Exactly. That's the tension in the market right now. Despite this massive bullishness, a majority, 57% of these big money managers, still believe stocks are overvalued. They seem to be chasing returns, maybe due to FOMO, fear of missing out, while acknowledging they might be investing near a peak.
Where is the anxiety concentrated?
It's concentrated in stocks with really extreme valuations. Palantir, trading at nearly 205 times next year's earnings, Tesla at 180 times, and Nvidia still trading at an aggressive 28 times its 2026 estimates. The fear that we are experiencing an AI-fueled speculative bubble is very, very real among these managers, even the bullish ones.
And before we move on to the Fed, it's worth noting the geopolitical disapproval among these managers regarding tariffs.
Yes, that was striking. Nearly two-thirds disapprove of President Trump's tariffs. They argue they are a drag on growth and a significant source of volatility, which obviously impacts their profit forecasts. That disapproval is quite strong.
Okay, now let's talk about the central bank. We anticipate a quarter-point rate cut at the upcoming FOMC meeting. That seems baked in. But the real story, according to Barron's, is the probable end of quantitative tightening, QT.
Right. The rate cut itself is almost a certainty. It's fully priced in by the market now. The true significance lies in what the Fed does with its balance sheet. They've been engaging in QT, systematically allowing assets like treasuries and mortgage-backed securities to roll off their balance sheet as they mature. This effectively drains reserves from the banking system.
And they're stopping that.
The sources indicate they are preparing to announce an end to QT, primarily to avoid what they fear could become a financial plumbing problem in the banking system.
We've used that term plumbing several times now. For our listeners, let's try to break down this highly technical issue clearly. What exactly is the mechanism signaling that liquidity is tightening too much? And why does the Fed feel the need to stop draining reserves now?
Okay, think of the financial system like a house's plumbing system, and bank reserves are like the water pressure in the pipes. When the level of reserves gets too low, the whole system becomes fragile and prone to clogs.
Okay.
The crucial alarm bell that recently sounded is that the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, or SOFR, recently traded above the Fed's interest rate on reserve balances, or IORB.
And what does that mean in simple terms? Why is SOFR topping IORB a problem?
SOR is essentially the benchmark rate for banks lending to each other overnight, using treasuries as collateral. IORB is the rate the Fed pays banks just to park the reserves at the Fed. When SOR, the market rate for borrowing cash, jumps above IORB, the rate for just holding cash safely at the Fed, it indicates that reserves are no longer ample in the system.
Banks are getting nervous.
Banks are starting to hoard cash because they fear they might not have enough liquidity readily available. This situation is precisely the kind of precursor we saw leading up to the September 2019 apocalypse, where the cost of overnight borrowing briefly soared to 9%, causing market panic. The Fed absolutely wants to avoid any repeat of that kind of market disturbance.
So by stopping QT, by stopping the drain of reserves, the Fed is effectively manipulating market liquidity to avoid a systemic clog. And analyst Stephen Blitz points out this ultimately supports the equity market, right?
That's the critical conclusion he draws. Blitz argues, quote, given how equities are the linchpin keeping this economy afloat, the Fed is not going to let macro arguments get in the way of supporting stocks.
So financial stability trumps inflation fighting, maybe.
It suggests the central bank is prioritizing financial stability and preventing market panic, even if it potentially compromises their fight against inflation or their stated goal of maintaining tight policy for longer. And this action looks particularly stark when you look at the underlying economic data mentioned. David Rosenberg's AI-driven Beige Book analysis supposedly shows only 18% of the U.S. economy is currently in expansion mode. That's the lowest level since the depths of the 2009 recession, if you exclude the pandemic shock.
Wow. So the Fed is supporting the market despite some significant underlying economic fragility. This takes us perfectly into the highly speculative behavior we're apparently seeing. The market loves junk stocks.
Yes, this is a classic late cycle indicator and frankly a massive red flag, according to many analysts. We are seeing extremely speculative activity being rewarded handsomely. A basket of heavily shorted stocks, these are often companies that are fundamentally weak or troubled, surged 24% in the last month alone.
24%.
And perhaps even more concerning, the small cap Russell 2000 index, where a stunning 40% of the constituent companies are currently losing money, is outperforming quality indices.
That composition where profitless companies are thriving, that really echoes the late 1990s dot-com bubble, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. Mm. Kailash Capital research analysts were quite blunt, stating that the small cap benchmarks are, quote, drowning in garbage. When market speculation starts rewarding shiny new objects and companies that are burning cash rather than earning it, history shows that durability beats drama in the long run. The advice from these sources is pretty simple. Avoid what they call the garbage. Stick to quality.
But even within the massive AI theme, there is apparently a way to find quality at a reasonable price.
There is. Investors need to focus on the quality companies that can actually execute and generate profits from the AI trend, not just the hype. Citigroup identified what they called an AI at a reasonable price basket.
What's in it?
It includes names like Booking Holdings, Instacart owner MapleBear, and Pinterest. These companies trade at P.E. ratios well below the S&P 500's current 22.3 multiple, yet they are seen as having real AI leverage. And the penalty for missing earnings right now is severe. S&P 500 companies that missed expectations recently fell 4% on average, compared to a historical average penalty of just 2.6%. So quality execution is absolutely essential for surviving this kind of environment. Hype alone won't cut it.
Okay, moving from speculative hype to real infrastructure demand, let's look at the energy required to actually power this AI boom. Barron's highlights America's largest natural gas producer, Expand Energy, suggesting it's well-positioned to meet this surging demand.
Right, Expand Energy, which was formed by the merger of Chesapeake Energy and Southwestern Energy, seems to have a huge competitive advantage here. Their assets are geographically situated near major LNG export capacity along the Gulf Coast, and that export capacity is projected to basically double by 2029. That's a solid baseline demand driver.
But the real secular tailwind, the long-term story, is the AI-driven electricity demand, isn't it?
That's what really excites analysts, yes. The projected growth rate for global data center electricity consumption is just staggering.
How much?
It is projected to more than quadruple globally by 2030. Largely driven by optimizing all these AI models. This demand provides a substantial and, crucially, non-weather-dependent floor for natural gas used in power generation.
That's key for an energy company.
It's golden. It means a steady, growing, long-term customer base that's divorced from the usual vital factors of industrial consumption cycles or, you know, how cold the winter is.
And the merger synergies, the cost savings from combining Chesapeake and Southwestern are apparently already exceeding expectations.
That's the financial kicker, exactly. The synergy savings are now projected at roughly $600 million annually by the end of 2026. This is driving consensus earnings estimates to jump dramatically from about $5.69 per share in 2025 to an expected $9.63 per share in 2026.
And the valuation.
Despite some recent volatility in natural gas prices, the stock trades at a pretty modest 11 times those 2026 earnings estimates. And the technical picture, according to the article, shows a strong rebound underway after hitting lows over the summer. So, fundamentals, secular trends, and technicals seem aligned here.
Okay, let's pivot sharply now to high-risk global sovereign debt, where volatility in politics are absolutely everything. Argentina heads to the polls in a crucial midterm election. The outlook for its bonds sounds highly binary.
Yes, Argentina's sovereign bonds are currently trading at really distressed levels, with spreads similar to debt from war-torn Ukraine. That reflects the extreme political risk involved. The market is entirely focused on President Javier Milei's ability to secure his government's position.
What does he need to achieve in these midterms?
He needs to prevent the opposition Peronist bloc from gaining a veto-proof supermajority in the lower house. That's the key threshold.
And what happens if he suffers a sizable defeat? What's the risk?
According to analysts like Aleo Chirwanco at UBS, a sizable defeat means the, quote, downward spiral would resume. It would jeopardize his ability to pass the tough austerity measures and structural reforms that are necessary to stabilize the economy long term. This political risk is precisely why the U.S. intervention is so public and, well, a bit messy.
Messy how?
Well, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent initially promised a $20 billion swap line to provide liquidity. But then President Trump complicated things by dangling a further $20 billion, making it seem conditional on the election outcome, which adds another layer of uncertainty.
Right. But regardless of the political outcome, the core economic problem remains the same, doesn't it? The peso is seen as overvalued and must be devalued soon.
That's the unavoidable economic hurdle. Mark Sobel, a former Treasury official, noted that any significant devaluation risks reigniting the massive 30% plus annual inflation that Milei has actually managed to quell recently. So it's a real catch-22.
So for investors,
for short-term bond traders, the election result is everything. It's a binary trade on political sentiment. However, Matt Gertkin of BCA Research takes a longer view. He asserts that Argentina is fundamentally an improving emerging market story on a 5 to 10 year horizon if you assume eventual political stability allows the reforms to take hold. Big if, though.
Okay. For investors seeking yield, but maybe with a bit more stability than Argentinian bonds, let's look at fixed income again. Specifically, the PIMCO Multi-Sector Bond ETF, ticker PYLD, which is delivering an attractive 6% yield with comparatively lower risk, according to the article.
Yeah, this fund has seen its assets surge pretty dramatically, up to $8.5 billion since its launch less than 3 years ago. That's a testament to its performance, especially in a challenging rising rate environment. The fund manager, Sonali Peer, employs a highly active go-anywhere strategy, meaning they invest across a wide spectrum. Corporate bonds, securitized assets like mortgages and CLOs, and even emerging market debt. The real emphasis is on active credit selection, relying heavily on PIMCO's extensive global research team to identify mispriced assets and opportunities.
And the fund's key positioning right now reveals a tactical approach. They are apparently heavy on securitized assets, specifically agency mortgages. Why those assets in particular?
Agency mortgages. These are mortgages backed by government-sponsored entities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, offer yields that are currently similar to investment-grade corporate bonds.
Mm-hmm.
But, crucially, they come with an implicit government guarantee.
Ah, the safety net.
Exactly. That guarantee provides a level of stability and liquidity that corporate bonds simply lack, making them a strategic component for a fund that's focused on generating high yield, but with relatively lower comparative risk than, say, high yield corporate junk bonds.
And they're also positioning for global rate cut expectations outside the U.S.
Correct. They are actively positioning for a steepening yield curve where long-term bond rates rise relative to short-term rates.
Yeah.
And they're trying to capitalize on expected rate cuts in places like the U.K. and Australia.
Why the UK and Australia specifically?
Because those countries have a much higher percentage of floating rate mortgages compared to the US. This means monetary policy transmission. Basically, the time it takes for a central bank rate cut to actually impact the real economy and borrowers is much faster there. This allows the fund to potentially capitalize on these policy dislocations quicker than waiting for the slower US effects.
So that active, benchmark-agnostic approach is exactly what investors should look for in a multi-sector bond fund like this. Okay, let's dive into our corporate deep dive segment now, starting with a quick review of some analyst research highlighted on three key names, GM, Lithia, and Vertiv.
Okay, starting with GM. Benchmark Research maintains a buy rating. They cite strong execution and really robust cash generation, particularly from their legacy internal combustion engine, ICE, business, which is still a cash cow. But the caveat is clear. Near-term upside looks limited. They expect headwinds from tariffs, continued moderation in EV demand that seems persistent, and a gradual normalization of vehicle pricing as inventories build. So, Patience is advised. Maybe wait for a better entry point on GM.
Okay. Next, Lithia Motors, the auto dealer group, identified as a top pick by Seaport Research Partners.
Yeah, Lithia apparently posted excellent Q3 earnings, driven by strong growth in used unit sales and a solid performance in their after-sales business service and parts. Analysts were particularly impressed by the company's aggressive share repurchase activity, buying back their own stock.
Then the valuation.
Trading at just 7.5 times their 2026 EPS estimate, Lithia is considered highly undervalued relative to its growth prospects, according to Seaport.
And finally, Vertiv Holdings, an outperform pick that connects directly back to that AI infrastructure theme we discussed earlier with Expand Energy and Meta.
Right. Vertiv is seen as an immediate and tangible beneficiary of the whole AI build-out. They reported accelerated organic orders recently, resulting in a massive, visible $9.5 billion backlog of work.
That's huge.
It provides really strong visibility for growth well into 2026. Evercore ISI is bullish because Vertiv is a technological leader in power and cooling infrastructure. These are the literal machines that keep those energy-hungry data centers we discussed powered up and from overheating. The demand for Vertiv services is directly correlated with every new AI chip sold by NVIDIA or AMD. They need Vertiv's gear.
Okay, we briefly touched on the financial engineering at Meta earlier with the Blue Owl JV. Now let's discuss the corporate strategy and internal disruption. Zuckerberg is aggressively shaking up his staff to try and accelerate the company's AI dominance.
Yes, he seems to be treating the AI shift as a truly existential threat that requires immediate, aggressive, and maybe even ruthless action. The $70 billion CapEx spend is just the hardware side. On the human capital side, he's been intensely disruptive.
How so?
He aggressively hired top AI researchers for the newly formed TBD lab and a Meta Superintelligence Labs, often reportedly with nine-figure compensation packages to lure them away from competitors or academia. This was immediately followed by the layoff of 600 workers across other AI units within Meta.
Oof.
It was a swift reorganization, demonstrating a brutal focus. If you're not perceived as core to the new AI mission, you might be out. He seems determined not to let Meta get disrupted like IBM or others were in previous tech shifts.
Speaking of core AI players, the article notes that Microsoft's stock has barely budged since July, suggesting it might be coiled and ready for a breakout after its upcoming earnings report.
Yeah, analysts seem to be positioning for a catalyst there.
Yeah.
They expect an 11% increase in earnings, primarily driven by a predicted 30% plus surge in revenue from their Azure cloud platform.
And that's linked to OpenAI.
Heavily linked. Microsoft's deep, almost symbiotic partnership with OpenAI is the engine here. Customers using OpenAI services run them on Azure. Despite some concerns over Microsoft's own massive spending on AI infrastructure, analysts believe this CapEx growth should moderate next year, perhaps shifting investment toward more profitable AI-supporting hardware. The stock has been consolidating for a few months, and the upcoming earnings are widely expected to reaffirm its status as a core quality AI play.
Moving to investor actions now, we see activism stirring up corporate strategy in both the biotech and crypto mining worlds.
That's right. Shaw Capital is targeting Novavax, the vaccine maker. They're demanding a formal strategic review and potentially pushing for a sale of the company due to what they call significant share price underperformance, operational and marketing failures. Strong words.
And in crypto mining.
Meanwhile, Situational Awareness, which is an investment group, is actively increasing its stake in Core Scientific, the Bitcoin mining company. This is happening despite Core Scientific's pending $9 billion all-stock merger agreement with CoreWeave, an AI cloud provider.
So they're buying more even with the merger pending.
Yes. Situational Awareness is increasing its position even as some other large shareholders have apparently voiced opposition to the merger terms. This suggests they see underlying value in Core Scientific itself, perhaps regardless of whether the merger goes through or what the final terms might be. It adds another layer of complexity to that deal.
We also have a rather bizarre yet highly illustrative anecdote about market sentiment in the quantum computing sector involving Rigetti Computing.
Oh, yes. This story perfectly captures the extreme fragility and sentiment-driven nature of these pre-profit deep tech sectors. Rigetti's shares plunged nearly 15% in a day after completely false rumors circulated on social media platforms claiming that the CEO, Subodh Kulkarni, had sold his entire stake in the company.
Which wasn't true.
Completely untrue. The CEO had to issue an immediate clarification stating that his 0.8% interest is primarily held in vested and unvested options and that he has absolutely no plan to sell. But the damage was done, temporarily at least.
And earlier that same week.
Earlier that same week, The stock had actually jumped significantly on an equally unfounded rumor that the Commerce Department might be considering taking an equity stake in Rigetti, part of that state capitalism trend we discussed. The Commerce Department quickly denied those talks.
So the stock whipsawed violently, purely based on rumors of either massive insider selling or massive government intervention, neither of which was real.
Exactly. It just shows that the quantum computing sector, like some other emerging tech areas, trades almost entirely on sentiment, hope, and potential future relevance, given they aren't expected to generate significant profits for years, if ever. The slightest whisper of insider action or government interest can trigger intense volatility. It makes it a very high-stakes, sentiment-driven gamble for investors right now.
Finally, let's close this section with an insider move at the Olive Garden parent company, Darden Restaurants. The stock is slumping amid tariff woes, and two executives recently sold shares.
Yeah, Darden stock tumbled after they reported rising food and labor costs in their latest update. Specifically, they called out higher than expected prices for beef, and they partially attributed that to the U.S. tariffs recently imposed on Brazil, which have apparently reduced beef imports and thus increased domestic costs.
And executives sold.
Amid this stock price decline, two executives, Matt Broad and John Martin, sold shares in October. Now, the size of the sales wasn't enormous in the grand scheme of things, but the timing selling after the tariff-driven stock slump was announced caught analysts' attention. It can signal a cautious sentiment from within the company about near-term prospects.
Okay, now that we've covered the policy, the plumbing, and the corporate strategy, let's pivot and offer some tactical advice for portfolio diversification and maybe even some lifestyle advice relevant to retirement. We begin with a strong argument made in Barron's for using single-country ETFs as a potentially better hedge against U.S. market risk.
Right. The common investment wisdom often holds that global stocks pretty much move in lockstep with the S&P 500, making broad international diversification somewhat redundant, or at least less effective than hoped. But the sources here argue this is fundamentally false.
Why?
Because broad international funds, like those tracking the MSCI EAE Index, often track the U.S. market too closely. They tend to be heavily weighted toward large multinational companies headquartered abroad, but these companies often generate a significant chunk of their revenue in the U.S. or China anyway, so you're not getting true diversification. True diversification requires non-correlation.
And the data from 2022 apparently proves this point quite dramatically.
It really does. In 2022, while the S&P 500 plummeted 18%, some single-country ETFs tied to markets undergoing major structural shifts performed brilliantly. Chile was up 24%, Brazil was up 13%, and the volatile Turkey ETF was up a stunning 106%. Single-country funds give you exposure to distinct, often idiosyncratic local economies and drivers, not just global macro trends.
So what are the three actionable single-country picks favored by strategists mentioned in the article right now?
They favor countries undergoing some kind of major structural transformation. First, Vietnam. It's aggressively benefiting from the friendshoring trend as multinational manufacturers look for alternatives to China for their supply chains. It trades at a relatively high PE of 20, but perhaps justified given the growth story compared to the S&P 500's 28.
Okay, Vietnam. Second.
Second, Greece. Greece is benefiting from a recent debt upgrade back to investment grade, and crucially, its announced upgrade to a developed market classification by FTSE Russell, expected in 2026. This upgrade will eventually trigger massive passive index fund flows into Greek equities as global funds rebalance.
That's a powerful technical driver. And the third favored pick relates back to our massive AI discussion.
Yes, Korea. Strategists view Korea, a global leader in memory chips and semiconductor manufacturing, as a cheaper way to gain exposure to the AI chip trend compared to, say, NVIDIA directly. This is coupled with ongoing internal corporate governance reforms in Korea, aimed at benefiting minority shareholders, which could unlock value. So the argument is these single-country ETFs can provide portfolio non-correlation that broad international funds simply cannot deliver as effectively.
Speaking of diversification, let's look at dividend stocks. They are often misunderstood as only being for retired investors seeking income, but the article suggests that's not the whole picture.
That's a really critical distinction. Vanguard research cited shows that most income-oriented investors, particularly those still saving for retirement, actually automatically reinvest their dividend payouts. They're not using the cash for current income yet.
So why buy them if you're just reinvesting?
Primarily for diversification and perceived reliability. Dividend-paying companies are typically value names, often older, established businesses. They yield an average of around 4.5% currently, and trade at lower multiples than the high-flying, growth-focused tech giants that dominate the indexes. They offer a different risk-return profile.
And there's a powerful psychological component at play too, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Investors often view dividend-paying companies as more trustworthy or as better stewards of capital. That assurance of receiving regular quarterly payouts provides immense psychological comfort. It can help investors overcome the fear of being forced to sell shares during volatile market dips just to generate cash. So although dividends are generally taxed, whether reinvested or not, this strategy provides a vital, value-oriented counterbalance to a portfolio that might be heavily tilted towards high-growth, high-multiple stocks.
Okay. Finally, let's end our deep dive today with a piece of tactical lifestyle advice that kind of builds on our theme of how we've engineered activity out of modern life. Maybe seniors shouldn't avoid climbing stairs.
Yeah, this insight comes from exercise physiologists who note the paradox of modern retirement living, especially. We have actively engineered physical activity out of our lives. The trend towards having the first floor master bedroom is a perfect example. It removes a critical built-in source of low-level yet intense physical activity that used to accumulate throughout the day.
Professor Carrie Stewart noted that accumulated short bursts of intense exercise, like simply going up and down stairs regularly, are crucial for health.
Exactly. Stair climbing is significantly more intense than walking on a flat surface. It's highly effective for maintaining cardiovascular health, building critical leg muscles, which helps prevent falls, and improving balance. Some research even suggests seniors who regularly climb stairs may have lower mortality rates and are better able to maintain the ability to do basic household chores independently for longer.
So the goal isn't hitting the gym for hours.
No, the goal isn't necessarily formal gym training. It's simply integrating necessary functional movement back into daily routines.
The natural concern for any senior or anyone thinking about aging is the risk of falling on stairs.
Of course. And falls are a serious risk. But geriatrician Mira Sheffrin made an interesting point. Stairs equipped with proper handrails may actually pose less risk of a serious fall than, say, walking on uneven sidewalks or tripping over a rug. The pragmatic advice for home buying still seems sound. Ensure you have a first-story bedroom and bathroom option available for potential future health declines. But the key is to actively continue to use the stairs while you are healthy to build and maintain the strength and balance that helps protect you from falls later on. Don't give it up too soon.
That's a perfect encapsulation of the breadth of the sources in this week's Barron's, ranging from the highest level of government industrial policy right down to the simplest advice on personal health and aging. We covered the U.S. government becoming a major strategic investor, the deep anxiety over 24-hour trading, the clever financial tactics of Meta to fund its AI ambitions, and the fragile plumbing of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet.
It truly has been an exhaustive deep dive, and the core tension we've really uncovered throughout all this is the fragility that seems to be lurking just beneath the surface of record-high market sentiment. We've seen this massive bullishness, driven largely by AI excitement and the strong expectation of Fed rate cuts.
Right.
Yet at the very same time, we know the Fed is being forced to manipulate market liquidity by stopping QT, essentially to avoid a potential plumbing crisis in the banking system.
Right.
And geopolitical risks, from tariffs impacting corporate costs to sovereign debt crises brewing in places like Argentina, are clearly escalating.
This really raises a fundamental and, I think, provocative question for you, the listener, to consider. How long can market psychology sustain these record-high valuations when the underlying economic structure, the financial plumbing, signals increasing technical and geopolitical fragility, fragility that is forcing unprecedented government interventions, both domestically and perhaps internationally? What structural risks are you, perhaps, actively ignoring right now simply because of the fear of missing out on the current AI euphoria?
That's the crucial self-assessment for every investor right now, I think. Weighing the momentum against the underlying cracks.
Excellent point to end on. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material from Barron's. We hope you feel thoroughly informed and better equipped to navigate these complex markets.
Until next time.